Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight is a particular honor for me because, let's face it, my presence on this stage is pretty unlikely. My father was a foreign student, born and raised in a small village in Kenya. He grew up herding goats, went to school in a tin roof shack. His father, my grandfather, was a cook.
Welcome to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. To learn how you can showcase your business or nonprofit, go to our website at TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com for details. Man, we have another great show in store for you today. So sound the alarm. Get on Facebook, Twitter, Foursquare, or Tumblr. Send out emails and text messages. Call your friends and family and tell them to tune in right now to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. And for those of you that are listening via Blog Talk Radio, leave your comments. Click the follow button or follow me on Twitter, and that's at TaylorMade101. I'll be reading your tweets live on the air. And I also have a chat room open. Out there in the chat room, you can leave your comments or ask questions. So whatever your pleasure, chat room, Twitter, Facebook, or just plain old my bell, we want to hear from you. But first, let's take a look at the current events. Everyone, I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. We have another great show in store for you today. So let's take a look at what's on tap. My brother's keeper, what do you think about the president's initiative? Is the Cold War heating up? Russia, Ukraine, are we asking our troops for too much? And the Oscars are tonight. Who's your pick? We discuss this and much, much, much more. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Now, before we get started, I'd like to the listening audience and my national prayer warriors to lift up two of my classmates. Now, specifically Rodney Sturkey and Sharif McNutt, a.k.a. Shaq. And also Myra Thompson, if you're listening out there in Radio Land, he needs you to call him. So Shaq is really trying to get in contact with you. Now, my thoughts and prayers are with you both, and as well as your families, we will keep you lifted up. So let's get started. First up, my brother's keeper. Now, if you didn't know, President Obama has launched an initiative to raise the level of consciousness in America, I say, on the promise and potential of young men and boys of color. Now, this initiative is dubbed My Brother's Keeper. Now, this is an effort by President Obama to talk about how we can lead our young men of color and a nation as a whole. Now, let's take a look at what the problem and how the president is taking action by the administration. Let's take a look at what he's really trying to do here. Now, if you go out to whitehouse.gov, pretty much you will find out specifically what the initiative is all about. But he wants to address two fundamental problems. It says understanding the problem. The data proves it. Boys and young men of color, regardless of where they come from, are disproportionately at risk from the youngest years through college in their early stages of their professional lives. Now, by the time they hit fourth grade, 86% of African American boys and 82% of Hispanic boys are reading below proficiency levels, compared to 54% of white fourth graders reading below proficiency levels. Now, African American and Hispanic young men are more than six times as likely to become victims of murder than their white peers, and accounts for almost half of the country's murder victims each year. Now, quite naturally, this is a staggering account of what's happening. But the president has made some strides in trying to take some action. Here's what he says. He says he's announced a new initiative with leading foundations and businesses that will take a collaborative, multidisciplinary approach to build ladders of opportunity and unlock the full potential of boys and young men of color. And they're getting to work immediately. So he signed a presidential memorandum establishing the My Brother's Keeper Task Force to help determine which public and private efforts are working, how the federal government can support these efforts, and how we can get more folks involved in those efforts across the board. And that doesn't only benefit our kids facing tough circumstances, but it benefits all Americans, he says. Now, I think this is a very significant initiative, but I want to hear from you. Does the president go far enough? What about the timeliness of the initiative? In other words, is it too late? Do you think the Trayvon Martin and most recently the Jordan Davis murders had any impact on the urgency of this issue? Is the initiative lacking any components? To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. I would love to hear from you. Love to hear from you. Again, the number is 323-580-5712. Now, I want to play the president in his own words so you can kind of hear, kind of in his own words, what he's trying to do and the impact that it's having on the young men, and also how personal it is to him. So take a listen to this. Here's the president in his own words talking about My Brother's Keeper.
When I was their age, I was a lot like them. I didn't have a dad in the house. And I was angry about it, even though I didn't necessarily realize it at the time. I made bad choices. I got high without always thinking about the harm that it could do. I didn't always take school as seriously as I should have. I made excuses. Sometimes I sold myself short. And I remember when I was saying this, Christian, you may remember this, after I was finished, the guy sitting next to me said, are you talking about you? I said, yeah. And the point was, I could see myself in these young men. And the only difference is that I grew up in an environment that was a little bit more forgiving. So when I made a mistake, the consequences were not as severe. I had people who encouraged me, not just my mom and grandparents, but wonderful teachers and community leaders. And they pushed me to work hard and study hard and make the most of myself. And if I didn't listen, they said it again. And if I didn't listen, they said it a third time. And they would give me second chances and third chances. They never gave up on me. And so I didn't give up on myself. I told these young men my story then, and I repeat it now, because I firmly believe that every child deserves the same chances that I had. And that's why we're here today, to do what we can in this year of action to give more young Americans the support they need to make good choices and to be resilient and to overcome obstacles and achieve their dreams. So they're examples of extraordinary achievement. We all know that. We don't need to stereotype and pretend that There's only dysfunction out there. But 50 years after Dr. King talked about his dream for America's children, the stubborn fact is that the life chances of the average black or brown child in this country lags behind by almost every measure and is worse for boys and young men. If you're African American, there's about 1 in 2 chance you grow up without a father in your house. 1 in 2. If you're Latino, you have about 1 in 4 chance. We know that boys who grow up without a father are more likely to be poor, more likely to underperform in school. As a black student, you are far less likely than a white student to be able to read proficiently by the time you are in fourth grade. By the time you reach high school, you're far more likely to have been suspended or expelled. There's a higher chance you end up in the criminal justice system, and a far higher chance that you are the victim of a violent crime. Fewer young black and Latino men participate in the labor force compared to young white men. And all of this translates into higher unemployment rates and poverty rates as adults. And the worst part is we've become numb to these statistics. We're not surprised by them. We take them as the norm. We just assume this is an inevitable part of American life instead of the outrage that it is. That's how we think about it. It's like a cultural backdrop for us in movies and television. We just assume, of course, it's going to be like that. But these statistics should break our hearts, and they should compel us to act. You know, Michelle and I are blessed with 2 beautiful daughters. We don't have a son. But I know if I had a son, on the day he was born, I would have felt everything I felt with Billy and Sasha, the awe, the gratitude, the overwhelming sense of responsibility to do everything in my power to protect that amazing new life from this big world out there. And just as our daughters are growing up into wonderful, beautiful young women, I'd want my son to feel a sense of boundless possibility. And I'd want him to have independence and confidence. And I'd want him to have empathy and compassion. I'd want him to have a sense of diligence and commitment and a respect for others and himself, the tools that he'd need to succeed. I don't have a son, but as parents, that's what we should want, not just for our children, but for all children. And I believe the continuing struggles of so many boys and young men, the fact that too many of them are falling by the wayside, dropping out, unemployed, involved in negative behavior, going to jail, being profiled, this is a moral issue for our country.
You know, that was, to me, very impactful. There was a lot in there. He talked about the mistakes he made, how the climate is different now than it is when he was coming up, how he was able to make mistakes and get, you know, second and third chances, how people didn't give up on him. And he also talked about the statistics, how, you know, how African American young men are doing poorly, or brown men are doing poorly, lesser than their white counterparts in reading. They've been suspended at higher rates. The criminal justice system, they're more likely to be victims of a violent crime. How the job labor force is not really kind of catering to their cater to them. And most importantly, he said that we're becoming numb. You know, we're looking at like this as is this, if it's the norm. But when in reality, it should break our hearts. It should compel us to act. And as a parent, we should not just want this for our own children, but for all children. You know, and this was really, you know, to me, in my estimation, something that the president has had on his agenda for quite some time, because he's talked about it in the State of the Union addresses in 2013, and he mentioned, you know, what he was going to, you know, do this year in the State of the Union address. But when you see a Trayvon Martin and you see a Jordan Davis lose their lives way before their time, I'm sure this has compelled him to act. So I want to get your take on this. I mean, you know, when you listen to the initiative, you listen to what the problems are, you listen to what he's trying to do, you know, what are your thoughts? Does the president go far enough? What about the timeliness of the initiative? In other words, is it too late? Do you think the Trayvon Martin and the most recent Jordan Davis murders has had any impacts on the urgency of this issue? Is this initiative lacking any components? You know, when people begin to go out and talk about what the president is doing and his initiatives, they always trying to say, you know, he should be doing this or he should be doing that. I want to get your take on that. You know, is it missing any components, or do you think it's sufficient? You know, when I look at, you know, us having, when I say us, the United States of America having the first African-American president, and one in which is a strong image to project, a strong, serious family man, has, you know, has two daughters, has a beautiful African-American wife, talks about his heritage. He's really enacted policies that will really change the way their African Americans are treated. And so, you know, what do you think about this? Well, joining me in the studio is the executive producer of Current Events and the chief operating officer of Cook Enterprises. You can follow her on Twitter, and that's at AskJema. That's AskJema. I introduce to some and present to others, no other than Jema Hill Cook. Jema, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, I've briefly introduced the president's legislation, or at least his initiative, I should say, entitled My Brother's Keeper. And I talked about how the administration has defined the problem. You know, they said that the problem is basically by the time they hit the fourth grade, 86% of them, boys, and 82% of them are reading below proficiency levels. How African Americans and Hispanic men are more than six times as likely to be victims of a murder than their white peers, and account for almost half of the country's murder victims each year. He mentioned in his, and I kind of played for the audience the fact that he mentioned the statistics around reading, suspension, crime, violent crimes, and jobs. And the fact that the nation is becoming numb to this issue. So I want to get your thoughts, A, about the initiative, and then B, I want to kind of walk through the questions I asked the audience. Does he go far enough, right? What about the timeliness of his initiative, and do you think Trayvon Martin, Jordan Davis had anything to do with him moving up the timeline? And is this initiative lacking any components? So let's start with, does he go far enough?
Well, the short answer is he goes far enough in terms of what he can do himself in terms of being president. I think it's important for us to remember that the grunt of the work isn't going to come from Washington, but he has the power and as they call it, the bully pulpit, to stand in front of a nation and remind us of the things that are important to us as a nation, since he sits in that seat right now. So as he goes, so should the nation go. So if we're concerned about the rights of others and being our brother's keeper, then he is by far the one that should start the conversation. So on the one hand, yes, it goes far enough because it has been topical, and it has kept us talking about it. My fear is that because, as you mentioned in your opening, we've become so cynical about things that we'll forget about this initiative. And so how do we in the media and how does the White House and the Obama administration keep this initiative topical so that those philanthropists and entrepreneurs and CEOs of companies will begin to do their part to help fund what you know, the programs out there that are working and to keep them running. So it's a good first step. I by no means am going to say what's lacking in this, because when you have nothing and you get something, just be thankful for getting something. So I won't speak on what's lacking. I will say that I hope each of the programs that are out there already that are working, it is my hope that we will begin to duplicate them and not reinvent the wheel. And we all should know, anybody that's done any kind of work in social services, have done anything working with children, that you have to include the family. So that's kind of a, I've just seen a lot of things lately about what about the family, what about the family. Well, I can't help, if I just help you and I don't do anything to help your environment, then what family is involved in that? And so I think, if anything, we just have to figure out ways to manage it and to duplicate those programs and services that are already being provided in some of our communities of color. And those that are working, we continue to fund. And those that are not, then we move on to something else.
You know, that's an interesting position, especially about the family. I know you've done a lot of work in this area, and I always like to say you are – our resident expert in this particular matter, because you worked in the field. You was director of a large institution. You went out on the road, and you was a consultant for Missouri Youth Services Institute, which was one that's touted by the Harvard reviews, and has received a lot of accolades for the work. And so, when you mention the families, I think it's important to kind of emphasize that, because although, as you mentioned, the president has kind of used his bully pulpit to begin the conversation, I don't think it stops there. I think it is now a way to really emphasize the focus and let people know that this is something that is near and dear to my heart. But it's incumbent upon us as young African American men and our white counterparts, and our Latino counterparts, and our Native American counterparts, and our other counterparts throughout the United States, our Muslim brothers, our Christian brothers, to get together and say, look, we have a problem. And I think the president has clearly laid out what the problem is. And so, and I like the fact that he extended the problem beyond just the African-American families and says this won't just impact them, but it'll impact the United States of America. Because when they have jobs, when they have upward mobility, when they feel like they're wanted, then it's easier for them to kind of want to be a part and not do those destructive things, or not be in a position where people want to destroy their lives and not take their lives as if they were real people. And so when you talk about the family, I think the family is extended beyond just the walls of a person's domicile. But it goes out into the community, out into the city, to the churches, to the community centers, to the neighbors. You know, it extends beyond that. So when I look at family, I look at all of those things, but I look at, as you said, the president starting the conversation, using the bully pulpit, saying, let's use best practices, let's get out there and make this work. You know, because the reality is Congress is not going to earmark any dollars towards this issue. There's not very few representation of brown people on in the legislature. So when you're talking about, and there's not that many constituents or lobbyists that can go out and lobby Congress for funds to earmark towards supporting these initiatives. So again, I think it's incumbent upon us, and when I say us, men, all men, not just men of color, to take this initiative, take the baton from the president, and then move it forward. So,
But I think it's also important that we remember, as I stated, you know, if you were to really, if you really want to, you know, impact your community and have an initiative such as this happening in your community, then partner up with someone that's already doing a piece of it. So we know the Boys and Girls Club does a lot of things around mentoring. Partner up with your local Boys and Girls Club and find out how they can extend that out a little bit. You know, I was watching Deion Sanders' show last night. He has a show that comes on Saturday evenings now, and it's Deion Dad Rules or something. I can't remember. And he's raising 8 kids, and it's following him and his school down here, which is Prime Prep Academy, and his life there as the coach and working with the kids and his relationship with Tracy Edmonds and things of that nature. So what was interesting, though, as he's working with these young men, and it's an all-male school, there's no girls there, and he says that's because he doesn't want any distractions. You know, he wants them to focus on what it is, their education and football. So what he said was there was a young man that was struggling, coming late to school and late to practice, and he, you know, he pulled him to the side. He said, I need you to talk to me about what's going on with you, you know, what's happening. And he told, you know, one of the things he did with him, he said, I need you to write down all the things that your family needs that are not being taken care of, just your needs, you know, not your wants, but I need you to tell me what the needs are in your family. And after he did that, he said, and the boy gave it back to him, and he said, sit down with your mom and tell me about it. And he said it broke his heart because the young man was trying to do for his family what his mother was lacking. By that, she had just been laid off. The father wasn't around, wasn't active, wasn't providing any support, and they were now almost near homelessness and was sleeping on somebody's floor. And so what he said to her, and he brought them in and talked to her, and he said, you remind me of my own mother, and I know the struggles that she had to try to hold it all together, but he can't do it because when he's trying to do it, he's missing out on his education here at school because he's late for whatever reason. He's either missing the bus or he's out doing whatever he's doing, hustling, basically trying to take care of the things in the house so that things are taken care of for him and his siblings. And so when you have a program, an initiative such as Am I My Brother's Keeper, and we know Deion could write a check for anything, and he did. He gave her a check, you know, we never saw the dollar amount, and said, you know, this is, you know, just take it. And he broke down and cried, and she broke down. I mean, I was in here crying watching it because it was so touching that, you know, he knows that that's just a part of it. You know, that might sustain them for a little while, but after that, you know, how do you help her? In helping him, you help her by maybe she needs some job skills training, or maybe she needs to go back and get her GED or something that will lift her up just a little bit out of where she is. So when you talk about including the whole spectrum and making sure that young men of color have opportunities, they will only get these opportunities when we involve the whole community in the process. And so if there's a church already doing something, they may have a after-school tutoring program. Well, add to that tutoring, mentoring, you know, or if they have mentoring, add to it tutoring. Or, you know, I mean, just begin to add. It's not that we have to reinvent the wheel, and we should not get caught up on the who's doing it. I hope that this doesn't create schisms in the community where everybody feels they need to go branch off and do their own thing, because we are better when we are together, when we all work together for a common goal. We are better not only as a community but as a nation. The reason why so many people want to come to the United States of America, because they feel a sense there's something there. There's something happening over there that's not happening where I am, and I want to get over there and find out. And that's because we've created an environment that if you have what it takes, you will succeed. So we've got to make sure that we're making sure that our young men of color are having what it takes to succeed. And so when we when you talk about including all of that, that came to mind, that we make sure that when we improve the life of one child, we improve the life of one family, which then has an impact on that whole community.
Yeah, you know, and that's a critical issue. The fact that when we're talking about, you know, these initiatives, that people don't go out and says, hey, I want to do this, I want to do this, and I got this great idea. And I'm glad that really the president emphasized, let's use existing best practices, right? So implied in that is that don't go out and create something new. Don't go out, but you know people are going to do it, just like you said. They're going to try to go off and spin off their own thing because they want to take, they want the credit for it. And so when you have this type of mentality, it makes it very difficult for organizations that are having successes to be able to go out and really have an impact, because they have this scattered sense of execution, because there's no concentrated effort. When we can all coalesce around one particular cause, whatever your cause, if your cause is music, go participate with somebody's music. If your cause is sports, go participate with somebody that's doing sports. If your cause is STEM, go participate with somebody in STEM. And so we have all of these vehicles that are already in place that are having success, and we just need to join forces with them. And I think the president is trying to, you know, try to really emphasize that. Say, hey, we have people out there doing, let's use these best practices. You know, you often talk about, I think it's called Kibbs Academy in Brooklyn, where they're having 100% of their students go out and apply for college in a high percentage of acceptance rates. When you look at these other success rates around the country, these are the models that we should be looking to for the execution about this. So I want to ask you a question, though, about the naming of this, right, My Brother's Keeper. And I want to talk about it in the context of Genesis chapter 4, when it talks about Cain and Abel. And it reads, "Now Abel kept flocks, and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as offering to the Lord. And Abel also brought an offering, fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offerings, but on Cain and his offerings he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry, and his face was downcast. Then the Lord said to Cain, 'Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it.' Now Cain said to his brother Abel, 'Let's go out to the field.' While they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, 'Where is your brother Abel?' 'I don't know,' he replied. 'Am I my brother's keeper?'" And so I raised that because of this kind of tells the story of the African American nowadays, with this kind of chaotic and this is not the entire case, right? But there are pockets of chaos in our community where we are killing each other. And so I thought this was really interesting, and it kind of hammered home what we really need to be, you know, focusing on, and the religious implications, or at least the religious type of implications in this particular passage, in the naming of "Am I My Brother's Keeper?" What do you think about that?
I think personally the naming of it is critical, because what it says about the president, it challenges the naysayers that still want to make him be a Muslim, right? Without him saying he's a Christian, he goes straight to the Bible. He goes straight to the book that they hold so near and dear, although we know they don't do a lot with all them other scriptures in there. but it takes us straight to the heart of what he stands for as a man, and what he stands for as a father, and what he stands for in terms of how he wants us to treat those around us. And so when you look back at the name of it, and you have so many people that want to talk about people ought to be able to pull up their own bootstraps and stand on their own, but Scripture tells us that we're to be concerned about one another, and concerned to the point that we offer support when we need to, and that we know how another one is doing. And when they're not doing well, then we should be able to assist. So I think it's a great, 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 I don't want to say play on words, but I think it speaks to the essence of the core of who he is as a man, honestly.
Yeah, and then in the other little niche within that by using the word brother. I mean, we've affectionately called each other brothers for many, many, many years. And so when you add that piece in it, you know, it kind of gives that extra little, yeah, you know, he really understands who he is and who we are as a people. And for him to use the, I mean, it has to mean so many different meanings within just a title. And it should give us strength by knowing that.
And he could have just got finished watching New Jack City. And, you know, when Nino Brown asked him, "I'm my brother's keeper," and Lance had to say, "Yes, you are." He could have just got finished watching that scene. It was like, that's the name of it. "Am I my brother's keeper?"
Right.
Brother's
right.
Keeper. You never know. I mean.
Right. I mean, but so, it resonates on,
you know,
so
it,
many
it,
levels.
It speaks volumes.
Right.
Yeah, it does.
Exactly.
It speaks volumes to who he is as a man, to the core of his essence. And like you said, you know, the innuendos that can pop up out of my brother, you know, and how we, you know, in the vernacular in which we use things sometimes. And I can't say that in any other movie other than New Jack City have I ever heard "Am I my brother's keeper." I could be wrong, but I don't think I've heard that in any other movie. So that's quite interesting.
Yes, indeed. All right, it's time for a quick break. When we return, I want to shift gears a little bit and to talk about what's going on in Russia and in Ukraine. It's particular the president's response. You don't want to miss this segment. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
You are listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. My mom and dad will be right back after these messages.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, "Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy, and I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday." That's my friend, and of course, my Eastbourne friend.
Need a new website? Haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. Before we shift to Russia and Ukraine, I want to kind of wrap up the section and by saying that My Brother's Keeper is the president's initiative. It is incumbent upon you know, us as a people to really get out and take strides in this. But what I would really hate to see is the fact that we look to others to fix our own problems. And what I mean by that is, typically what you have is you have the president is partnering with corporations to kind of help fund this initiative. And you have people that have ideas of what the problem is because the data says reports about reading, the data reports about in suspensions and criminal justice systems and violent crimes, and it talks about, you know, labor and jobs. And so looking at just the data, you can kind of infer some things and say, here's how I should solve this problem. But without having a diversified or an inclusive, comprehensive plan towards execution, it would all be for naught. And what I mean by that is simply, if you have, you know, Caucasians or Latinos or Asians try to fix African American problems, you won't necessarily get the right solution. You will get a solution, but you might necessarily get the right solution until you have the diversity of thought and having people that really understand the issue participate. So what I would hate to see, you know, all the other groups that I just mentioned be the ones that are leading, that are driving the solutions without having African-American participation at the decision-making level, not just execution. I'm talking about strategic and not just tactical. What do you think about that, Jima?
Well, I agree with that. I think that the moment we forget that, you know, at the end of the day, all of this is going to, you know, have to, you know, be massaged enough to work itself into it, and then we got to remember the strategies of it and what the purpose of it is and why it's important. And if we ever lose sight of the why it's important, then this the president could have 12,000 initiatives. But, you know, the people on the ground still have the work to do. So I agree with you. There has to be.
And where I'm really going is, like, when you look at, in some instances, the Republican Party trying to make decisions for women and their health, because they don't have women helping making the decisions, you know, they look at the data. They look at, you know, they look at it from their lens and says, okay, here's what we think should happen, right? But them not necessarily knowing, you know, why a woman is making a decision about her body, or why a woman is choosing to take these certain steps. Looking at the data is not enough, and that's what I'm saying. So when you can unpack that, that says the African American cause is similar in that they have unique situations that are specifically that African Americans need to help address themselves. Now, you can look at the data, you can look at the statistics and say, hey, here's a solution that fits this model, and we've done this before, but we need to look primarily at African-centric solutions as opposed to just general solutions, because if I look at my lifestyle and because of where I live or how I eat, and I go out to into a neighborhood and says, hey, man, you should eat this or you should do this or you should do that, not knowing the environment in which I'm trying to implement this strategy, it could really cause more problems than it could about solving the solution, about coming up with the solution.
Right. But not only that, though, there's data to prove both of those already. So you're right. I mean, you can use the data to prove or in terms of you have, as we were talking about earlier, I can't think of the name of it, but it's a school out of Chicago where it's an all-male school, and the success rate that it has shown, we have data to show that. We have data to show that when you have educators in the classroom that look like the population that they serve, that the kids in the classroom tend to do better. We have data to show that. We have data to show that when you don't have educators in the classroom that look like the people they serve, kids don't do better. We have data to show that. So we have enough data. I think you say this all the time. We have data on top of data to prove, you know, what's working and what do we need to continue to implement. And if we're going to say, you know, if the president's initiative is for My Brother's Keeper is around young men of color, specifically African Americans, however, color also includes Hispanic and others, then – you're right. We need to take a look at at whether or not the things that have worked in the African-American community with boys will work with Hispanic young men or Asian young men or Native Americans, because we're not all alike. Our needs are somewhat different.
That's right.
So I agree that, right, your point exactly, and that we have to have the right people at the table, because just having, I mean, we have Clarence Thomas in the Supreme Court, but he doesn't, on no area, speak for me as a black person. So it's not just that we got a person in the room or a person of color, reviewing the research. You got a person that has the heart and mind of the people to review the data. Then that's going to give you what you need at the end of the day.
Yeah, I like that, because it's not necessarily the African American for the African American community, but the right African American for the African American community, and likewise
exactly.
for the Asian. Yeah. And so another critical point I want to make before I transition is, I haven't heard much about metrics, how we measure success in this area, because I think it's critical to say, here is where we are, and we have enough data on that, but here is how we're going to track our successes. Here's the targets. Here are the milestones that we need to try to target to see if we're doing better. Because if we don't do that now up front to set these goals, set these milestones, set these targets, then we could just go out and spend a whole bunch of money and not really see any impact. Or you may see impacts in certain areas and not in others, but because you're not measuring it in such a way, you're not able to tell how we're doing. And so I wonder, you know, what the initiative is really doing towards measurements or metrics, as capturing, you know, where we are now. I think they've done a really good job of, but capturing or at least outlining where we need to go as far as this initiative is concerned. Because, you know, I don't want this to be the president's attempt to solve a real huge major problem in brown, black and brown communities. But we don't really put enough structure on that says, here's how we check this progress, and here are the small victories as we can measure along the way.
Well, I think that's something that you unpack, because depending on what's your starting point. If there are different parts in the initiative, which from my understanding there are. You got some education pieces, you got some training pieces, you got some work readiness and those sorts of things. So if you say education, if you say you want to increase the average of African-American young men that graduate from high school from, you know, 45% to 60%, you know, what is it going to take to do that, right? And so then whatever those initiatives are in those communities that have, that have high graduation rates, you know, what are they doing differently from those whose graduation rates are even lower? And that's how you begin. So if I'm in Dallas County here, and our graduation rate in Dallas County is 30%, you know, me getting to 45% is an increase. So it would still have to be, you know, community specific enough that those communities would take ownership to getting to the next level.
My point exactly.
All the data is right, and when all the data is collected and aggregated, then we should see an increase, you know, to where we're trying to get to. So we're talking about that education. What needs to happen in the classroom? What sort of remedial coursework is most beneficial? Is it one-on-one tutoring that works best when you're trying to catch a student up to grade level? Those sorts of things, you know, we have to begin to drill down from the pie in the sky. We have to begin to drill that thing down. And we talk about always peeling back the layer. So we have to begin to peel back that layer around education, around job readiness. And what does job readiness mean? He identified that in the State of the Union that Joe Biden and some other Joe was going to be getting with people about instituting a jobs training program. And there was some pushback on that. But I stand as a person who back in the day when they used to have, the name just ran out of my head, but there used to be job training back in the day. And that's how I got my first job, was through that, you know, I think I've turned out okay over the years. And so we've got to, that's not to say that the government is doing it, but you find an organization that's all they do. and that's job training. And you find an organization that all they do is work on education and test scores and getting you grade level and all that. You find and getting you ready to take and pass your GED. You find those different types, and so it could all happen under one umbrella. You know, this day is for this. It could happen all in one place, or your child might have to go to three or four places. But at the end of the day, that parent has to be active enough in the child's life to get them to where they need to be so that they can receive the services that are being offered for them. And so, you know, all of that, and when it's all said and done and you wrap it all up and you crunch all the numbers and you say this is a good deal, you know, how are we going to get it done? It's just like you decide that you want to lose weight. Okay, you say you have a goal to lose 50 pounds. How are you going to lose 50 pounds? Just me saying I'm going to lose 50 pounds is not going to magically disappear. I have got to participate in the process for that to happen. I'm either going to eat one less meal a day. I'm not going to have sleep this week. I'm going to cut back on my salt. I'm going to cut back on my sugar. I'm going to cut back on something. I'm going to walk a little more. I have to do something to get to the loss of that 50 pounds. And so the initiative can be there, but the students have to show up. The parents have to make it important. The student has to have a mind to want to be there. It's just like the person that's an alcoholic or a drug addict, and they go to three and four different treatment facilities, and then you keep wondering why they're coming out and they still want to do drugs, because they haven't gone for themselves yet. They keep going for everybody else. The moment they will go for themselves is the moment they can say, I'm an addict and I need some help. And then, you know, the process will begin for them in terms of them coming out of it. But until that happens, they have to participate. To say I want to be drug-free, you got to do something. To say I want to be the best basketball player, you have to work at that. You're just not going to wake up and be the best. You still got to practice. You have to show up. You got to condition your body. You know, when you look at the regimen that LeBron put his body through to be at that level every single night, that's grueling. You know, when you look at what Ray Lewis used to do in the off season, they don't have an off season. You know, he's training before training camp starts, because he to be ready for the season, you get ready before the season starts. So all of that. So in order for us to take advantage of the opportunities that's going to come with this initiative, we have still got to participate in the process. This is not the president did not just wave a magic wand and all the ills of the Black community and Latino community and wherever else, it goes away with my brother's keeper. It doesn't work that way. We still got work to do.
You know, that was well said, well said. So I want to shift now to Russia and the Ukraine. Now, in my estimation, what we knew as the Cold War is heating up again. And in a recent report by CNN, Ukraine's new leader accused neighbor Russia of declaring war. As Kiev mobilized troops and called up military reservists in a rapidly escalating crisis that has raised fears of a conflict. Now, amid signs of Russian military intervention in Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula, Russian generals led their troops to three bases in the region, demanding Ukrainian forces surrender and hand over their weapons. Now, a spokesman for the Crimean Media Center told CNN, speaking by phone, he said, Russian troops have blocked access to the bases, but added, there is no open confrontation between Russia and Ukraine military forces in Crimea, and said Ukrainian troops continue to protect and serve Ukraine. This is a red alert. This is not a threat. This is actually a declaration of war to my country, Ukrainian interim prime minister said. Now, what is President Obama's position? That's the question. And what is he doing about it? And so I want to talk from this article that said President Obama spoke for 90 minutes with Russian President Vladimir Putin yesterday in what appeared to have been a testy exchange reflecting an escalating battle of wills and growing international tensions over Ukraine. Now, Obama's expressed deep concern over Russia's violation of Ukrainian sovereignty and territorial integrity and breach of international law, the White House said. He called upon Putin to pull Russian forces, now reportedly spread across Crimea, back to their bases in the autonomous Ukraine region, according to a White House statement, and made clear that Russian refusal would lead to suspension of U.S. participation in planning for the upcoming Group of Eight summit in Sochi, Russia, scheduled for June, and greater political and economic isolation. Now, here's the challenge for me. Putin likes to, what we call back in the day, high side. That is showing off how big and bad he is, when in most cases, this show of brinksmanship is a front. On the contrary, President Obama makes every effort not to deploy troops, not to show force, but man, when he decides, it's on. I can tell you that. Now, what is also challenging for me is, in the event things do escalate, is the fact that Congress and the president, who asked our troops to participate in another conflict, especially after the recent legislative losses. And when I talk about the losses, here's what I mean. In an article by CBS News entitled Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel to Recommend Deep Budget Cuts Targeting Pay Benefits, here's what the article says. Teeing up what could be politically explosive fight before the midterm elections in November, Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel on Monday will recommend billions of dollars in annual budget cuts that will reduce housing allowances, that's BAQ, basic allowance for quarters, and other benefits, increase health care premiums, and limit pay raises. Now, the recommendations, first reported by the Wall Street Journal, are part of a broader effort to trim the Pentagon's budget while minimizing the impact on preparedness and capability. The Pentagon argues that personnel cuts are simply too big a share of the defense budget to ignore. Personnel cuts reflect some 50% of the Pentagon's budget and cannot be exempted in the context of the significant cuts the department is facing. Now, a spokesman told the journal, Wall Street Journal, Secretary Hagel has been clear that while we do not want to, we ultimately must slow the growth of military pay and compensation. The recommendations would limit pay raises across the board to 1%, and they would freeze pay entirely for generals and admirals for 1 year. Why is this concerning to me? As I look through this lens of a combat veteran myself, I served over a decade in the United States Army, conducted two tours overseas, and I was a part of 7 Corps, 2nd and 2nd ACR, whom spearheaded into Iraq during the first Gulf War. We've asked of our soldiers to conduct two concurrent wars, Iraq and Afghanistan. We take them away from their families time and time again, and sometimes would argue for unjust wars. Moreover, the suicide rates are something that the media rarely covers. Now, Ken Allard said it best in an article he wrote called Alienating Those Who Defend Us. He said, newsflash, when our soldiers and Marines are sent back into combat time after time, it increases their chances of becoming a casualty of losing their lives, their limbs, or maybe their sanity. Those are only the nastiest probabilities. How about the absolute certainties, the strain endured by our troops and their families immediately, as well as extended? So, Jima, what do you think about, what are your thoughts on the military being asked to do so much when their pay is already substandard for what they do? Now, in the event that we go to another conflict with Russia.
Well, I think in its totality, the federal government has, in my opinion, not done right by its veterans, not just from our most recent wars, but even the ones previous to that. When you look at a system that has not automated itself yet, and there's just layers. I mean, you know, you watch Jon Stewart, who at least once a month has a story on the Veterans Administration and how backlogged they are with paperwork, and that it doesn't seem to be a sense of urgency on anybody's part to develop a system that will help our veterans out at this point. So that's a tad bit frustrating. And then you look at the fact that I believe it was in the Senate this week where a vote was taken on the benefits for a veteran, and it was defeated by because it didn't get 60 votes in the Senate. And yet here we are, as you stated so eloquently, on the cusp of probably another intervention in some other foreign soil, and these are the same men and women with whom we've shown so much disrespect to in terms of how we treat them upon their return. But yet we expect them to be ready to go at a moment's notice and to carry out the order. And they will, because that's who they are. That's what they represent. But I just find it a bit disingenuous when our Republicans in office can speak about military budget, and but that budget isn't inclusive of the real needs of the soldiers themselves. It's all the materials, the investment in the building of something, because somebody's getting a kickback from that, their district. The jobs there, the whoever's selling the government the material, they're getting a kickback. But the people, we spend more time investing in brick and mortar than we do investing in people, period. And so if they was to, take a look at that budget and cry a little louder about, those things, and then I would support, this sort of a notion of, where they're always talking about war, because we would be doing the things that we're supposed to be doing. But I can't agree with that right now. I just can't, because they haven't shown themselves to be honest and fair in how they treat our veterans.
Yeah, what you were talking about, I want to read from politicususa.com, and it reads, in a shameful display of partisan obstruction, the Mitch McConnell-led Senate Republicans blocked a bill that would have improved veterans' benefits. Senate Republicans blocked the veterans' bill by using a procedural maneuver to invoke the 60-vote rule. The final vote to waive the budget point of order failed, 56-41. Only two Republicans, Senator Dean Heller and Senator Jerry Morgan, joined with Democrats on the vote. Republicans claim that they blocked the bill because Majority Leader Harry Reid would not allow an up or down vote on an amendment that would have attached sanctions on the Iran bill. You know, they use this tactic by, invoking the 60-vote rule or attaching something to the bill by adding pork to the bill so they won't be able to, pass the bill because something it's not a clean bill, so therefore they can attach something else to it and vote it down. Which to me is sad, the fact that they put us through all of this harm, put us through harm's way, and have so many demands upon what we do our family. Now, granted, the argument is this is an all volunteer force. I get that. This is a force where you know that you're going to be going to war, or you have the notion or the possibility that you can go to war, and I get that too. But to cut the pay, that when you're already getting substandard pay, the decreased benefits, and to send the troops over to these foreign countries as pawns for a political agenda, and to support the military-industrial complex when none of the people that are getting most of the funding, billions of dollars, are not going over there fighting, losing their lives. So it's hard for me to continue to see how they would continue to treat the military in this way, especially when you're talking about fighting, war after war after war. I mean, I'm pretty sure that there's a notion in the military called combat fatigue. And so I know they're approaching this particular area because you can look at the suicide rates. You can look at the rates in which you have people are getting out of the military, or their families are in broken homes. And so it's disheartening to me to see the Congress treat the soldiers in this way. So, Jim, what do you think? What's the best course of action for the American people to take when they see these issues like this that Congress are doing to the troops?
I think it goes back to, once again, being a part and being active in your local governments, because it's who you're sending to Washington that is voting down these very benefits. And so, you know, if we're not taking care of the business we need to take care of when it's time to go out and vote, then this is what you get. I mean, so at the end of the day, we still have some culpability and responsibility in what's happening because of those people that sit there in Washington and profess and claim to be there for us and work for us, the will of the people, and yet the will of the people is not being met on any stretch. And so, you know, we've got to call our congressperson and ask them, how did you vote on this veteran bill that came up? And if you voted against it, why? You know, because, you know, I'm a veteran, or my brother is, or my husband is, or, you know, whoever you know that is, and you know what their struggles are. I mean, there's even statistics and data about the number of active duty military whose spouses have to receive food stamps and different sorts of assistance such as that. So how is that possible in this great nation of ours that, you know, those that will give their very lives for us have to receive public assistance? We should be ashamed of that. We should be embarrassed by that. But, you know, the powers that be and those that are in control, they're not concerned. And so we've got to do our part to make them see the error of their ways and that, you know, we're not going to take it anymore. We're not. We're going to bombard you, and we've got to be able to walk and chew gum. We've got to be able to do more than one thing at once. Yeah, I know I called you last week about gun control, but today I'm calling you about the veterans bill, and next week I might be calling you about this. But I'm gonna keep calling you every time there's an issue that's having a direct or indirect impact on my life. I need to call and find out where you stand on those things, and that's what we can do.
Yeah, you know, I also want to kind of mention, because I want to talk about this before we run out of time, but I want to kind of emphasize the fact that, you know, when we go to our elected officials and we address, you know, a question just like you just stated there, what do you stand on military veterans? What do you stand on their benefits? And they tell us no. And a lot of times we feel powerless. You know, we feel as if, you know, we get a few of us together and we try to get a vote in. They don't listen to us. But I tell you that the most effective, and this has been proven by, you know, by several different examples. I have several different examples of this. But, you know, the power of the almighty dollar. You know, people don't have lobbyists for the most part, but companies do. And so by proxy, we can lobby against the companies and not spend our dollars with those companies. And, you know, if they support these elected officials and say, hey, if you're going to support this elected official that is not supporting our troops, then we're going to lobby against you by not spending our dollars in your organization. And that has proved to be effective in a lot of cases. You can look at what happened in Arizona with when they kind of struck down the last bill against the LGBT community. You can look at the Montgomery bus boycott and the fact that they said that, you know, that we're not gonna spend any money on these buses. We're gonna walk, and they did that for a year. And so, you know, if we can have the tenacity to stand up to these elected officials, and if they don't want to budge because they're thinking we're just one individual, and we can really coalesce around the power to vote, we can begin to lean on them with our dollars. And our dollars, by saying that, you know, these companies that are supporting these issues, we sometimes, I mean, we really adamant about an issue, gun control, you know, the military benefits. If we're really adamant about it, I think we need to start standing up with our dollars. What do you think about that?
I agree with that, and I agree we have to also recognize that a lot of the changes that occurred in our lifetime and the early part of the 20th century didn't happen overnight. I mean, so, you know, we rallied and we people were out there in support when it was getting some gun control legislation in, and it didn't happen the first time. But that doesn't mean that we just stopped pressing. And so we're looking now at the stand your ground, you know, and we have to target. We have to be, you know, specific about that thing. So what you, when you bring up the Montgomery bus boycott, their focus was on riding the bus. And they knew that if we don't ride the bus, there's, that's money you're not going to get. And at some point, it, not getting that from us is going to be more than what you're getting from others. So you will have to take a look at me not paying my quarter, a nickel, a dime to ride your bus, because now I'm going to have a direct impact on you and your profit and your bottom line. And that is when the change occurred, when the relief was not coming, and it was, and the pain began to be a little bit unbearable. Somebody was like, okay, look here. Okay, I've stretched this as far as I can go. All they want to do is sit on the bus. And still, like you stated, you know, that happened over a year. Those people walked in the rain, in the snow. They saw the whole season come and go and start all over again. In the heat, we're talking about, you know, Montgomery, Alabama, it's hot down south. So, you know, they saw all of that happen, and they took the time and they waited on it. And as you stated, when you start talking about economics of things, because at the end of the day, Jan Brewer didn't do what was right because it was the right thing to do. She did it because of the money. And that's the conversation we need to have. She did it because the Super Bowl was threatening to pull out.
That's
she
right.
She did it because the hotel industry told her how much tourist money they was going to lose. Somebody show her the numbers of how much money is spent, how much money is spent by the LGBT community in the state of Arizona. That's why she did it. You know, she didn't do it because just that bill in itself was out of order. So, you know, when you hit people and you show them the potential of losses, because this is just nothing had happened yet. This is just a potential. So, and one of the things, and I don't know who we're going to talk about it today, but one of the things that's going to come out of the march and the rally that's going to happen on March 10th now in Tallahassee, Florida, as it relates to the Stand Your Ground law down there in Florida, in reaction to and response to the Trayvon Martin case and the Jordan Davis case, what the leaders and those people that are planning that rally are going to walk away with, they are going to be doing some strategizing around, okay, so we've heard from the African-Americans and Hispanics and people of color in the community that say, if y'all stop coming, then you're going to affect me as well as a worker. You know, if the tourist people stop coming, you know, then I might not have a job too, so we don't know if that's a good idea. So they're beginning to strategize and target. Okay, we might not come to your state, but we might have a day where we don't spend here, or we don't do something in this, you know, from this name brand or this particular company, or, you know, we may, you know, boycott, you know, this type of place. So they're going to begin to strategize, but we've got to know that even on March 11th, Stand Your Ground is not going to be overturned in a day. And there are 23 other states that will eventually be met with sort of rally cry that's going to happen down in Florida. So we've got to be ready and be mobilized to deal with whatever that fallout is going to be, because there's going to be some fallout. But when it's tied to economics, as you stated, when it's tied to economics, people hear economics.
Yeah, I wonder, though, that, you know, that's a great point. I wonder, though, if we have the stomach for, or do we have the patience for, to see it through. You know, back in the 1960s, when you had the Civil Rights Act passage, and you had, you know, the Montgomery bus boycott, you know, people were really coalescing around issues. And I think today, in 2014, you know, it seems to me that people are comfortable. They have amnesia about all of the struggles that took place. They're less willing to go out in record numbers to for a cause. And so I wonder, though, as we move towards really being power to the people, are we going to exercise those rights? And that's what's kind of problematic for me, is that we know that we have to get together. We know we have to, you know, to make some sacrifices in a lot of cases. But are we willing to do that? And if we are, that's how we can win. Because otherwise, you know, is really about the money. And in a lot of cases, those big corporations have a lot of that.
Well, and I think when you say we have the staying power, when you talk about the Montgomery bus boycott, which I think was in 1954, and we talk about the passage of the Civil Rights Act, which was 10 years later, you know, that didn't, that one thing didn't lead to the other thing directly right away. It took some time for both the Civil Rights and the Voting Rights Act to pass. Neither one of those things just happened instantaneously. And so we have to have the fortitude to stay with it and not give up and not have a microwave mentality of, okay, it didn't happen, so we're just going to go on and not worry about it, or nothing's ever going to change, or, you know, whatever we end up coming up and telling ourselves. So you're right, we do have to have a stick-to-itiveness that this generation has not had to have before. Because
I know,
that's
what's key. That's
right,
what's key.
Right. This generation is used to things being their way. And so they don't quite know what it means to be denied something. And so we don't know if they have the fight in them. We'll find out. It looks like, they show up when it's time to show up. There seems to be a loud rallying cry. I mean, they had 80,000 people show up down in North Carolina the other week for their moral march on Mondays. And 80,000 people is huge for North Carolina. And so to show up about voting rights. So if this is possible, you know, if people have the fortitude, and we have way more ways of connecting with people than they did back when they decided not to ride the buses. All they could do was meet at the church, and it spread by word of mouth. When we have so much technology now with Facebook and Twitter and Tumblr and Instagram and the internet and your TV and your phone, I mean, you got 10 times more ways to communicate than they did, you know, 50, 60 years ago. And so hopefully, because we have so many ways to get the word out, that it will stay topical and people will stay energized about wanting to get out there on the ground and do some work.
Yeah, great point. All right, time for another break. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. Be back in a moment.
Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Shima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Current Events with Patrick Cook is joining the fight with First Lady Michelle Obama to help feed hungry children and stop childhood obesity. During the school year, many children receive free and reduced price breakfast and lunch as a result of the school breakfast and national school lunch programs. However, when the last bell sounds, marking the end of the school year, for many, it marks the beginning of hunger that will plague them throughout the summer. Here at Current Events, we're going to fill that nutrition gap and make sure children can get the nutritious meals they need. To learn how you can help with this worthy cause, go to TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free. That's TaylorMade101.com and click on Hunger Free.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy. And I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend. And of course, my Eastbourne.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Current Events with Patrick Cook.
Patrick Cook.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Secretary of State John Kerry will travel to the Ukrainian capital Kiev Tuesday to meet with government officials. Western powers are reacting to Russia's effective takeover of the Crimean Peninsula, a move that came after the recent ouster of Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych. Meanwhile, thousands of people filled Kiev's Independence Square today to protest against Russia. NPR's Emily Harris reports.
Glory to Ukraine was the repeated refrain at this rally, but the focus was on Russian President Vladimir Putin. Hand-painted signs told Putin to go home. Russia has declared war on us, one politician boomed. But Sidor Kirai was one of many people at the rally who doubt things will go that far. I strongly believe there will be no war in Crimea, he said. To start a war in the 21st century is politically crazy. National pride was on full display at the packed demonstration. Despite calls at this rally for a diplomatic solution, many here said if they had to defend Ukraine militarily, they would. Emily Harris, NPR News, Kiev.
In Brussels, NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen says Russia's actions have violated a UN charter and says the alliance is reevaluating its relationship with Russia.
Military action against Ukraine by forces of the Russian Federation is a breach of international law. It contravenes the principles of the NATO-Russia Council and the Partnership for Peace.
Earlier today, Russian President Vladimir Putin reportedly accepted a proposal by German Chancellor Angela Merkel to engage in dialogue regarding the Ukraine crisis. More than 1,000 Southern California homeowners are being allowed to return home after a powerful storm brought inches of rain and mudslides to the area. NPR's Nathan Roth reports.
More than 10 inches of rain fell in the mountains northeast of Los Angeles over the weekend. That rain raced down fire-scarred hillsides, causing mudslides and washing out roads. Roughly 1,200 homes in the nearby foothills were evacuated late last week before the storm. Only one was declared temporarily uninhabitable Sunday after the worst of the storm had passed. The storm hit the entire California coast. Downtown LA received more than 4 inches of rain. Downtown San Francisco got more than 8. Forecasters, though, say it won't end California's long-running drought. The state's rainfall is still far below where it would normally be for this time of year, and the weather is expected to return to hot and dry conditions as early as this week. Nathan Rott, NPR News.
4 hikers have been rescued after they became trapped by rising floodwaters in a California state park. Officials say they are unharmed. This is NPR News. The famed Iditarod Trail sled dog race is underway. 69 mushers and their dog teams are poised to attempt the 1,000-mile journey from Willow, Alaska to Nome. From member station at KUAC, Emily Schwing reports this year's competition is fierce, and so are the trail conditions.
The Iditarod Trail is snow-free in places. There are reports of bare rock and open water. With above-freezing temperatures, it's challenging weather for thick-coated sled dogs. But 3-time finisher Jake Berkowitz says he's ready.
I love it. I want the heat. I want the bad trails.
There are 6 returning champions and at least 20 other fiercely competitive mushers. Berkowitz is one.
Man, we're not looking at top 10 finishes. There's about 5 or 6 that are vying for a win.
Over the next 2 weeks, teams will travel nearly 1,000 miles before they reach the finish line in Nome. For NPR News, I'm Emily Schwing in Anchorage.
A crowd of onlookers cheered as Chicago's Polar Plunge got underway today. The annual event raises money for Special Olympics in the city. Mayor Rahm Emanuel says this year was record-breaking in terms of fundraising.
This fundraising for the Polar Plunge, which I think is a record year,
yep,
they're going to hear a report, a record year to make sure that every child in the city of Chicago stands strong in saying, we don't have a person to waste, everybody has something to contribute, and to show off what they have worked all their time doing.
Several thousand people turned out to support those who took the icy dip in the 32-degree waters of Lake Michigan. I'm Winsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number of the call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. I want to talk a little bit now about the Voting Rights Act. It's back in the news again, believe it or not. I know this is an election year, and typically there are always some tactics out there to try to prevent some from voting, and it's unfortunate. You know, I mean, this country is supposed to be the model for democracy, and yet and still we have people out there that are trying to suppress votes. And this time is in Ohio. I want to read for you an article from News One, and this is entitled "Defending the Voting Rights Act: Let's Make History Again." And it reads, since the dismantling of the Voting Rights Act, the right to vote has seen an increased amount of attacks with one goal in mind, keeping you away from the ballot box. But if 2012 proved anything, we can continue to make history as we fight the forces of suppression. Just this week, it goes on to say, Ohio lawmakers passed two new laws that make it more difficult for voters to access the ballot box. Specifically, two bills introduced by Republican lawmakers, of course, passed the legislature. The first of the bills would cut 6 days from the early voting period. Again, the first bill will cut 6 days from the early voting period in the state and end same-day voter registration. The second bill will discontinue practices of mailing absentee ballots to all registered voters by the County Board of Elections, but would allow the Secretary of State to send them out if lawmakers decide to pay for it. Both the bills will be in effect during the election in November. Ohio has been long a state with voting challenges, and these new changes will do nothing to help voters who want to participate in the election. Jima, why are we back here again?
The short answer is because, once again, they recognize that those dates are important to a certain group of people, to a certain voting block of people, and they want to do all that they can to ensure that those rights are restricted, some are violated, some are dismantled, to keep people away from the polls. But they should have learned their lesson, because what happened when the last presidential election was that because there was such a onslaught of the attempts of so many different state houses to restrict access to the polls, it encouraged people even more. And so I'm wondering if during this last go-round and they saw this urgency that people had and they went out and voted and they stood in those long lines anyway, if now they're like, okay, well, since that didn't work, let's try this. And so they will continue to try to do everything they can to discourage people from wanting to vote as opposed to encourage. And this is critical because we know midterm elections across the board generally have a lower turnout for Democrats. Democratic voters tend not to vote in high numbers during the midterm election. And so it is going to be very crucial, critical, of vital importance for the Democratic National Committee to make sure that states are on top of making sure people are registered and are voting, however you have to get there. So if you know right now that this is what the potential problem is in Ohio, then the people on the ground, your local civic organizations and advocacy groups on the ground need to already be planning for. I think you and I were talking about it, and so I said, okay, they don't want to do Sundays and souls to the polls, then most people have a midweek Bible study, midweek church service. Use that night, you know. Start a little early. Take your seniors out. You know, have a day. If you have a midday Bible study, use that time to go and get those people to the polls. Don't be one-dimensional in how you get there. So if they choose to do it that way, then we have to now start already coming up with alternative ways to make sure that we are encouraging people to go and vote.
Yeah, that's so true. I like the fact that Reverend Al is getting involved in this. And in fact, it says, in an issue that the National Action Network will be addressing at the 2014 convention, which is scheduled for April the 9th through the 12th in New York City, and beyond, as we partner with other organizations to address how we prepare voters to participate. But beyond April, we need to be inspired by the work of the people that help us gain the right to vote in our history and commit ourselves to working against those people who would like to see our voting rights become a thing of the past. We can do what we did in 1965, and in 2012, we can make history again. And so it seems to me that here we are again addressing something that, you know, in 1965 with the initial passing of the Voting Rights Act, and then the fact that the Supreme Court struck down a section of it, and then now these states are trying to take advantage of this, Texas being one and Ohio being another, trying to take advantage of the fact that the Supreme Court struck it down. So it seems to me, here we are again, it seems like to me this is something that we continually have to fight in the United States of America, which is just odd to me.
Yeah, that we're back. Yeah, we take two steps forward and five back sometimes in certain states. But once again, I know I'm beginning to sound like a broken record, but once again, this goes back to our lack of participation in midterm elections as well as in our local politics. These are your local people in your state houses of representatives and your state senates and your state secretary of states that are doing these things. And so if we're not electing people that have our best interest at heart, then this is what we get. So we've got to do better at being on top of the issues. I mean, I leading up to our primaries here in Dallas County, you know, I was getting the calls every day, three, four times a day from people about different judges that are up on the ballot. And my response was, I'm reviewing everybody's information before I tell you you can count on my vote or not. I thank you for calling, you know, but I still have to do my part. I still got to make it to the poll on Tuesday because I missed early voting. So I still got to go out there and vote, you know, and I will be there on Tuesday. But so if I don't vote in the local things and talk about school boards, we talk about city councils, we talk about your mayor elections and all, we talk about all of those things and how important and how critical they are, because if we fail to vote on those things, we get what happened in Arizona. That was a state issue. We get what's happening in Ohio. We get what's happening in Florida. We get what's happening in Texas, because those are all state things that are happening. So we still have a lot of work to do to get that into people's minds and heads and hearts, that your local elections, these midterms, these off years where there's not a presidential, are more important in some instances than what happens in Washington, because a lot of things that are happening in your state, which are governors, Republican governors, refusing the Medicaid expansion, which is impacting 4 million people. 4 million people are impacted because of states that decided they didn't want to do the Medicaid expansion. And you look at those states of Texas and Louisiana, Arkansas, Mississippi, all those different types of states that failed to accept the Medicaid expansion, and the majority of them received the most income from the federal government. So, you know, well, you've got to do your part on the local level. You have to.
Yeah, this is so true. So I want to shift now to the Oscars. Now, the 86th Academy Awards are tonight. It will be hosted by Ellen DeGeneres. And we have 12 Years a Slave on the ticket. So my question, Jima, for Best Picture is nominated. It's also nominated for Best Actor in a Leading Role, Best Actor in a Supporting Role. And so there's another Best Costume Design, Best Directing. So my question to you is, what are the chances that 12 Years a Slave be actually win any of the awards tonight? And if so, which ones do you think will come out on top?
I really hate to be a pessimist, but I have no expectations of the Oscars because every time I have some expectations, they let me down, and they let me down hard. So I just want to be utterly surprised and shocked and in awe when it happens. I can't invest any energy in it because I do not want to be disappointed, and they are notorious for disappointing me. So I just can't give. I can't give it to them because I don't want to be let down. Because then I'm gonna be mad and I'm gonna be angry and I'm gonna be, you know, pissed off to the highest level of pissivity at the Oscars for another year. So I'm just gonna wait and see. And I'm probably not even gonna watch it. I will find out who's winning via Twitter or Facebook because I can't do it.
Okay, so let's take a look at another category that I think that was pretty good. We saw a few of these. Best Animated Feature. You have The Croods, Despicable Me 2, Frozen, The Wind Rises, and Ernestine and Celestine. Of those, the ones that you've seen, which ones do you think are Oscar worthy?
Say those again.
The Croods, Despicable Me 2, Frozen, The Wind Rises, and Ernest and Celestine.
I think I've only seen one of those, and that was I saw Despicable Me 2. But I think the buzzword has been around Frozen. I mean, everybody is enamored with Frozen, so I'm going to probably say Frozen on that one.
Okay. All right, what about Best Original Song, since you're a songbird yourself? And the nominees are Happy, Let It Go, The Moon Song, and Ordinary Love. Ordinary Love is the out of Mandela, Long Walk to Freedom. Happy is out of Despicable Me 2, which is by Pharrell. And then, of course, Frozen, Let It Go was out of Frozen, and The Moon Song was out of Her. So Best Original Song, Happy, Let It Go, The Moon Song, or Ordinary Love?
Well, it should be Happy, because that song has been everywhere. So it should be Happy. However, it'll probably go to The Moon Song, which I have no idea what it was about. But that's what the Oscars. I mean, it'll probably go to The Moon Song. I'm serious.
Okay. I hear you. Obviously, you're not a fan of the Oscars, which is okay. I think that we've had some wins. And when I say we, I'm talking about the African American community has had some wins. I actually posted a few on my Facebook page. And that was some amazing displays of being an actor or an actress. So we have some victories there. So I suspect that we should have some victories tonight, based on all of the buzz around 12 Years a Slave. I think it will win Best Movie this year. I'm going out on a limb and go ahead and say that it will win the Best Actor.
I'm telling you now, he's going to win Best Actor or Best Movie?
Best Movie, and he's going to get the Best Leading Role.
No, okay. That's good. That's nice that you want to go out on that limb. I'm not going to go out there for it. I'm telling you, the sleeper is going to be American Hustle. I think that's where people, that's going to end up being a shocker. that's going to take it away from 12 Years a Slave.
So
you heard it here first.
Right. So 12 Years a Slave, Best Picture, and Best Actor in Leading Role will go to, I can't even pronounce his name, but she would tell Ejiofor. And 12 Years a Slave. He will get the two, they will get the best two. So, and I know that'll be late tonight, because they do that at the end. But when we wake up in the morning, if you don't watch it, I'll probably make sure I tweet it to you. All right, it's time for another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Current Events, Patrick Cook.
You are listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas. My mom and dad will be right back after these messages.
Cook Enterprises have joined forces with Google Inc. and Amazon.com. With this new partnership, our companies, TaylorMade Training and Consulting, Current Events, and Ask Jima, can now offer you the best deals 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Whether you're looking for discounted books for your book club or a very special gift for a friend, family member, or loved one, TaylorMade's Marketplace is where you should go first. Visit our website at TaylorMade101.com and click on Marketplace to get the best deals today.
Thank you for your call. Let me read you a couple of my Twitter family, and then I'll have you respond, Dr. Hutchinson. But I want to read the first one from one of my best Twitter family members, Ask Jima. And Ask Jima says, Reverend Al, today is my birthday, and I'm sitting in Barnes & Noble Starbucks watching you online, driving people around me crazy, and I want to wave at her and the folks she's driving crazy and wish her a happy birthday on her 21st birthday. That's my friend, and of course, my Eastbourne friend.
Need a new website? Haven't figured out your social media strategy? Are you finally ready to tweet, post, or blog? Well, look no further. Go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. We are the number one resource for small businesses and nonprofits. We're a full service, interactive consulting firm specializing in social media marketing, web design, technology workshops, as well as leadership and management training. So go to TaylorMade101.com. That's TaylorMade101.com. Google me.
Welcome back to Current Events with Patrick Cook. To join the conversation, the number to call is 323-580-5712. Once again, the number is 323-580-5712. I want to shift now to an issue that was in the news about Spike Lee. And this article out of ClutchMagazineOnline.com talks about, and it asks the question, did Spike Lee's gentrification speech cause vandalism? It talks about it. What reads like an act of retaliation against Spike Lee's infamous gentrification rant? Vandals sprayed "Do the Right Thing" several times on the house next door to Lee's old home in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. The current homeowner, who also had his windows broken, thinks the culprits were targeting the house next door where Lee's father currently lives. Lee has not made a statement about the vandalism, but his brother, Arnold Lee, has. Spike Lee needs to stop with whatever situation he was talking about over here, because he doesn't live here anymore, and he's not involved in it. Don't make it personal. So Jima, what do you think about A, the vandalism, and B, Spike Lee's gentrification rant?
Well, I think Spike Lee can say whatever he wants to say, as he does anyway. He doesn't need permission to speak out on something that those are his beliefs. If that's what he believes, that's what it is. The counter that is for somebody to say, well, no, these things were happening prior to. And so they should be easily able to have a civilized conversation about it without any name calling. Let's just deal with the facts. You know, when did the city change? When did these ordinances change? When did these things start happening? Because, you know, and he can talk on his side, and whoever wants to talk on their side can talk on their side. And this is a generational thing, because I believe the actor Anthony Mackie came out and said Spike don't live here no more, and he'll know what he's talking about. But this is generational. You know, there's those that saw it happening during their lifetime and speak from it from that vein, and then there's those that appeared and it was already there. And so they don't understand what it was like to have something that used to be yours taken away, or you know, the guy that used to could hang out on the corner and play his drums, he can't anymore because the neighbors now in the high rise are saying he's making too much noise. And that has, you know, that type of drum beat sound has been a staple in your community for centuries, you know, for years, decades. And now for that to be taken away because of a different type of person that is now living there, what have you said about the people that's been there? So I understand what Spike is saying, and, you know, and so, you know, he has a right to say that. He has, you know, you have a right to say it, as does the person come behind you has a right to say what they want to say too about what you said. Now, vandalizing and doing things of that nature, that's against the law. So they're going to get it for that. So, you know, I don't know what message they were trying to prove, but that doesn't seem like that's going to work out in their favor too much.
Yeah, so just for clarity for the listening audience out there, gentrification is a shift in an urban community towards wealthier residents and or businesses and increasing property values. Gentrification is typically the result of investment in a community by local government, community activists, or business groups, and can often spur economic development, attract businesses, lower crime rates, and have the other benefits to a community. Basically, what it means is that if a property is kind of ran down or hasn't been kept well or things of that nature, they begin to lower the price. And if somebody comes in and buy up all the property, and then, you know, those are on the outskirts of those people that used to live in the communities. Some are there, some are not, but they start to move these people in. They start to build back up the community. They start to raise the property value. And so now you have a different dynamics in this community. A good target of that would be what we see in Detroit, Michigan, because of the city was trying to file bankruptcy. A lot of the companies moved out of there, so the property values went lower. So you would have somebody come in there, buy up the property, start to build up high rises, raise the property value, and now people can't do what Jima just talked about. They can't play their drums. They can't play their music. They can't, you know, have the same cultural, you know, things they used to do years ago, because now the gentrification has happened. A shift is taking place in the community towards a different dynamic or a different community or a different culture or people. And so this is what Spike Lee was talking about. What's interesting to me is that the fact that the focus has shifted away from the gentrification piece more towards the vandalism and the communication that was expressed about him not being there. And so it's always interesting to me on how, you know, when we have a large issue like this, what really gains traction, right? The traction is not the gentrification speech, the rant or the speech or however you want to put it, but what's gaining traction is this vandalism and the fact that this guy's made this statement about Spike not being here. So, Jimmy, what do you make of this gentrification issue, but the target being something else?
Well, but here's my thing, though. I mean, why is it when Spike has a few words to say, he got to be going off on a rant? You know, why he has to, you know, like it's all negative to stand up and speak your mind on something? I mean, when George Clooney talks about what's happening in Darfur or wherever, he's not going off on a rant. He's educating the public on what's happening. So why the change in terminology for one to another? That's my first question. I mean, which I know we could spend a whole hour just talking about that, but I just had to get that off. The second thing is, you know, I'm a movie buff, and stuff reminds me of movies. And so, you know, instead of putting on there to do the right thing, they should have went back to Boys in the Hood, because Larry Fishburne's character, Furious Styles, talked about gentrification in L.A. in that movie.
Yeah, yeah.
So we act, you know, and that was out, Boys in the Hood was out 20-some years ago, I'm sure. So, you know, so the fact that Spike, as you know, in the famous words of Iyanla Van Zant, who says, you call a thing, he called it what it is. And now, and so now that you called it what it is, now people want to say you're going off on some rant, and they don't want to deal with what you called it. They want to deal with you going off. They want to deal with what the other person had to say to you. They want to deal with the vandalism, but we don't want to deal with the fact that what you, everything you said was true. But we don't want to talk about that part. We want to talk about everything else. We want to bring up every other time Spike has had a rant or Spike has spoken out against something. You know, we want to do all that and not deal with what he said and the validity
right.
of what he said as
right.
related to gentrification in that area. Yeah, that's what we allow people to do. We allow them to label us. Now he's a rebel rouser. Now he's an angry black man. Now he's having a rant about something that's real. And yet, you know, the George Clooney's of the world and Ben Affleck can go and testify and be seen as experts on something. But Spike Lee has to have a tangent.
Right.
But
I digress. Okay. I mean, we're approaching the end of the show here, and I always like to give you, the wise one of the family, an opportunity to express your views, give your final thoughts, and I'd like for you to do that at this time.
Well, as I'm trolling through the news here, I find something that is extremely comical to me, and that is that the NBA, it appears, is angry that LeBron James has chosen to wear a black face mask. You know, his nose was broken a couple weeks ago. And his first game back a couple of nights against New York, he came out in the black face mask. Well, they're telling him he can't wear that. So go out and do your research on that. We'll probably talk about that next Sunday. But they're getting a little bit, kind of crossing the line there a little bit on what kind of face mask he can wear. Because he's been wearing face masks all along.
Yeah, but they've been clear.
I have to say, this is the first black one I've seen.
Yeah, it's the first one. I think when I saw him, they call him Zorro or something like that.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of Batman-like. You know, I kind of liked it. So
I liked it, too.
Yeah, so, you know. I just think the NBA might be kind of overstepping their bounds a little bit, as Eddie Kane Jr. said in the Five Heartbeats. As we near the ending of or the beginning of election season, and we're having our primaries and different things across the country, I just implore people once again to go out and vote. Pay attention to what's happening in your local elections, definitely in your school boards, because they can be a group that's cliquish. And by that, it's a who-you-know type of thing, and so you really need to stay up on that. And be involved in your child's PTA interest. You know, we have a lot of things to offer, and I may not can make every meeting, but when I'm there, they know I'm there. They know I've been there. And so because I make sure they know I'm there, and I make sure they know who my child is. And so I'm aware of what's happening at my son's school, probably more than I probably should be, because I'm emphatic about knowing what's happening in his education environment and whether or not it's safe and whether or not he's learning the things he needs to learn. So be mindful of what's happening in your school boards, your city councils, and those things. And go out and vote. If you didn't get to early vote here in the state of Texas, please go out and vote on Tuesday, March 4th. For these elections that are happening locally, for these judges, for these state and local state representatives and senators, as well as some national representatives and senators and things of that nature, so that we, when it's time, that we get the right person going against the right person during the elections in November. But we got to take care of this part first. So please go out and vote. And try to do something this week that you haven't done before that you thought about doing, but you said you couldn't. You know, start a journal, start the first chapter of your book, write a song, write a poem, build something, do something different that you haven't done before. just expand your horizons. You know, I might sit and watch, you know, a 4-hour Fox News just to see what they're talking about, because I've never done that before. I've never watched a 4-hour Fox News, but I might have to do that, because I talk about them all the time. I kind of need to make sure what I'm saying is true. So that might be the thing I challenge myself to do this week, is to watch a 4-hour Fox News at some time. The only person I like on there is Greta, so she might be the only one I can watch for 4 hours. But other than that, you know, just take care of yourself. Those living in these climates, if you have elderly people, go check on the elderly. It's cold. We're getting sleet and things down here in the Dallas area, and it's snow in the Midwest. I see they've already canceled schools in the Tulsa School District because of the weather. And so if you know people who might be struggling to keep warm, go check on them. You know, make sure that, you know, that they're okay, or you know, that they have what they need to make it through. Because we know kids that when we don't have food, they may not have anything to eat. You know, so if you know somebody in your neighborhood or your community that might fit that, you know, slide by, you know, with a pizza or something, or, you know, something to make sure that the babies get something to eat. So, you know, just be your brother's keeper. You know, that's all I can ask you to do is to be your brother's keeper.
Well, that's our show for today. I would like to thank all the listeners for tuning in, and a special thanks to my co-hosts, the wonderful, the magnificent, Jima Hill Cook. Now, you can follow her on Twitter, and that's at AskJima. That's AskJema. You're listening to Current Events with Patrick Cook. I'm your host, Patrick Cook, coming to you live from Dallas, Texas, as I do every Sunday at 4 p.m. Central Time, 5 o'clock Eastern. We are the number one resource for small business and nonprofits. Now, don't forget to bookmark this site and visit my blog, and that's at TaylorMadeTalkRadio.blogspot.com. Until next time, remember, it is written, my people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge. So stay engaged, stay informed, and stay plugged in to Current Events with Patrick Cook. You're listening to the sounds of Joyce Spencer in Sweet Dreams. Take us away, Joyce.